This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What determines whether or not a prisoner should be paroled? In Michigan, that parole board decision is informed by a questionnaire that's called COMPAS. And my next guest believes that questionnaire measures for poverty rather than the real likelihood of whether someone will reoffend. Sonia B. Starr is with us. She's a professor of law at the University of Michigan, and she's the co-director of the Center for Empirical Legal Studies. Good to have you with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sonia, run us through a typical scenario as a prisoner is nearing his or her parole date. And tell us about this questionnaire called COMPAS.
COMPAS is an example of what's known as an actuarial risk assessment instrument. There are a wide variety of these instruments that are being used by different states' courts in sentencing, in pretrial detention, and especially there's been a longer history of using them in parole decision making. And in Michigan in particular, the use of these instruments at other stages is a bit more novel and not really phased in on a statewide basis. But the parole board does make use of these instruments, in particular this one called COMPAS. So what is an actuarial risk assessment instrument? Well, it's a way of statistically predicting the defendant's likelihood of reoffending on the basis of a variety of different factors. Now, some of those factors are things like the defendant's criminal history. There will be a number of variables relating to that. Some of them are based on a psychological assessment, essentially, of the defendant's attitudes. And then others will be assessments of the defendant, or in the parole context, the prisoner's past and their identity. And it's the characteristics that focus on the defendant's background, demographics, socioeconomic identity characteristics. Those are the features about which I'm particularly concerned.
Why is that?
COMPAS, like many of these other instruments, includes a detailed assessment of the defendant's employment status and employment history, financial status, financial history, family background. So COMPAS, for example, considers whether the defendant's parents have ever been convicted or incarcerated, whether the defendant's parents use drugs, whether the defendant or any of his family members has ever been a crime victim, whether the defendant or the prisoner, rather, comes from a high crime neighborhood. Now, all of those factors count against the prisoner in terms of predicting the prisoner's future risk. And that is based on statistical assessment of past offenders that have similar characteristics. So all of this is based on empirical studies about what kinds of things are statistically correlated with future crime. This may all be well motivated to protect the public, to prevent incarcerating people unnecessarily if they don't pose a high risk, and to make sure we do incarcerate people who do pose high risk. So I don't question the motivations behind adopting an instrument like this, but I think that it is very dangerous to make the punishment that somebody serves for a crime turn essentially on their poverty, because all of those factors that I just mentioned, they're all just different measures of socioeconomic disadvantage. And basically every marker of socioeconomic disadvantage in these actuarial prediction instruments will get you a higher risk score and mean that you will end up likely serving more time behind bars.
So you're saying that this idea that they're measuring these markers, measuring probabilities and not the person's mind?
Well, what I mean is they're measuring probabilities in a group average way. That is, they're making statistical claims about a past group of people that shared the person's characteristics. So they're essentially lumping the individual prisoner in with other people who similarly, say, were poor or unemployed or had poor high school grades or their parents were incarcerated. All of those things may very well be statistically correlated with committing future crime. But it doesn't turn on the defendant as an individual, and it doesn't turn in particular on anything culpable that the individual has done. So it's essentially making the length of a person's incarceration depend on who they are and how much money they have, rather than based on their criminal conduct or things that are within their control. And I think that all that that can do is compound the tremendous socioeconomic disparity, and also, even though it doesn't consider race, these factors are also strongly correlated with race. And so I think it can only compound the racial disparity in our criminal justice system, even in a system that doesn't have official consideration of factors like that. We already have to worry about those kinds of disparities in the criminal justice system. But to use an actuarial instrument that essentially makes it official, the state wants to treat you more harshly if you're poor because you're poor, that's what it means to put something, to score something as a risk factor in an instrument that is then going to be taken into account in determining how long of a sentence you serve. That, I think, is a really noxious message for the state to send, and it can only compound the existing disparities that we have. And I've been particularly concerned about this happening at the sentencing stage. That's what my research has been on. But I think that many of the same concerns are raised at the parole stage as well.
And we're seeing this, certainly, as you said, Michigan is not the only state doing this. There's a strong move nationally toward this use of risk assessment instruments in the criminal justice system. Why has risk assessment gained traction across the country?
The movement nationally, at the sentencing stage, actually, many states are using this much more broadly than Michigan is. At the parole stage, almost every state that has discretionary parole is using this in some form. And I think the movement is based on a couple of things. One is this general appeal of scientific and evidence-based practice. There's this currency of this idea that we want practices to be evidence-based, grounded in data, that applies in a lot of different areas of law. And I myself, I'm an empirical researcher. I actually believe that criminal justice policy should be grounded in data. But I think that there are certain kinds of tendencies to rely on data that really are just a mask for discrimination. And I think that that is what is going on here, even with the best intentions. I think one of the reasons that this movement has gained steam is because of, again, a very well-intended desire by critics of our bloated system of mass incarceration to try to find a way to reduce the incarceration problem. And I want to give credit, actually, to the Michigan Department of Corrections for taking this concern seriously, because they've actually adopted a number of reforms all connected to the Michigan Prisoner Reentry Initiative to try to reduce arbitrary reincarceration, in general, to try to reduce reincarceration rates and reduce the percentage of sentence that at least some portion of defendants end up serving. There's a sense that incorporating risk assessment will allow this goal to be accomplished without threatening the public. Those are valuable objectives, and I do think we really need to do something about mass incarceration, but I don't think that relying on somebody's poverty or their demographics, also things like gender and age and marital status, those all go into the instruments.
I know, Michigan.
I don't think that relying on those things can be our path. I think we need to find a way to use evidence to inform our criminal justice system without building in these discriminatory bases for punishment.
Now, Michigan has been using Compass for the past 5-6 years in parole hearings, and the Corrections Department says Compass will reduce the prison population and cut costs. Do you think that's happened?
Doing a risk assessment doesn't itself reduce the risk, the prison population. A policy commitment to incarcerating fewer people reduces incarceration. We don't have to use Compass or any instrument that takes these poverty-related factors into account to decide who gets out. We could base it exclusively on what the person has done, both in this case and their past criminal history. And by the way, there's research suggesting that a tailored analysis of risk that focuses on criminal conduct can actually accomplish very similar predictive value in terms of somebody's future crime risk. You don't really gain that much in terms of prediction by also taking things like poverty into account. You know, Compass, for example, it has stuff about your past criminal history, but there is very little in the instrument that talks about the specific crime that you're serving the sentence for and the nature of it, what your role in the offense was. Maybe an instrument that took that into account in more detail could be much more defensible on fairness grounds, while also getting reasonably good predictions of what risk you might pose in the future. You could really just have the legislature downgrading the sentencing ranges, which are often quite harsh, that apply to certain crimes, nonviolent crimes, things in which in general we can say that people who commit these crimes do not necessarily pose a big risk to the public. We don't have to say that the sentence for any given individual or the portion of the sentence that they actually serve behind bars should depend on who they are. We can just have our system not make quite as harsh judgments about what the punishment range should be for certain offenses that, in general, don't threaten the public.
Sonia, are there states using some kind of a risk assessment instrument that you think fits what you're talking about and not focusing on things like poverty?
Yeah, this is a new effort, but there's research funded by the Laura and John Arnold Foundation trying to develop and assess risk assessment instruments at the bail stage. At the bail stage, that's when courts have to decide whether to release the defendant in advance of trial, and one of the questions is whether they'll pose a risk to the public while they are released. So in many ways, it's a very similar predictive enterprise to what happens in parole. And there's this public safety assessment that some researchers developed for the state of Kentucky to use in pretrial release, and they have found that phasing that in enabled them to reduce crime by up to 15% among defendants on pretrial release, and that instrument shies away from using economic variables. So I think that it's possible to get considerable gains without relying on these kinds of instruments. I do want to say that I'm not totally sold on the idea of using actuarial risk assessments at all, though. I think that one could do what courts have traditionally done in sentencing and what parole boards did before they shifted toward using actuarial instruments, which is to rely a lot more on individualized assessments of the person's case and what they actually did and then what that tells us about what they might do in the future, rather than trying to make generalizations grounded in statistics like this at all. I'm not totally sold on the fact that we need an actuarial instrument of any sort, but it is certainly possible to design them without including these problematic variables.
Sonia, we know the parole board's big issue and big challenge is to decide that crucial question that does this person have the potential to be a danger? And a lot of people believe it's better to err on the side of keeping someone incarcerated rather than risk a crime being committed by a parolee. And they feel this helps to reduce that chance. And to that you say?
Reduce the chance that they will commit a crime in the future? Well, if that's the rationale for it, then it is not necessarily consistent with the view that it's also a strategy for reducing incarceration, right? That is, I think it's true that a lot of times a high-risk assessment will lead to somebody being denied parole when they would otherwise be released. And that's a reason that I think it's not just that we're releasing the relatively privileged, it's that we're punishing people for being poor. And I think that's also likely when high-risk assessments are used at the sentencing stage. Now, I think there's no getting around the fact that both parole boards and sentencing judges are faced with a very difficult, morally challenging dilemma of how to treat an individual fairly while also protecting the public from crime. And I do think that protecting the public from crime is an important part of the mission of the criminal justice system. It's not all just about worrying about the defendant and what they deserve. But I do think that what the defendant morally deserves is a really important constraint on the state's ability to punish somebody. And I don't think that somebody deserves to be punished differently on the basis that they were once a crime victim, right? Or that their parents were a crime victim, or that their parents went to prison, or that they live in a high crime neighborhood, or that they don't have a variety of different privileges that other people have. protecting the public is very important, but it's just not the only value that our criminal justice system has. There is a fundamental value of fairness and equity among people that is really important to the legitimacy of the criminal justice system. You know, mostly what protects the public from crime is not the fact that people are locked up, and it's not even the fact that people are afraid of getting arrested. It's that they have internalized the values of the criminal justice system. That is, that crime is not something that most people want to commit. And part of having a criminal justice system that helps people to share those values, to choose to comply with the law, all of that turns, I believe, in substantial part on the system being seen as fair and legitimate. And a system that says that your punishment is not just going to turn on what you did, it's going to turn on who you are and how much money you have. It compromises a lot of that moral legitimacy. And I don't know, I mean, it's a bold empirical claim to say that thus it might actually harm public safety. I don't know for sure what the net effects would be. But I think that it's definitely not impossible that in the end our efforts to protect public safety in this way might compromise the system so much that it will be unable to accomplish its justice promoting. The Supreme Court, in a case called Griffin, referred to the protection, or rather the equal treatment of rich and poor criminal defendants, of all criminal defendants, no matter who they are, as the fundamental purpose, the basic aim of our entire justice system. I believe that that's true, that the idea that everyone stands equally before the courts and before the criminal justice system is a value that we should not throw away in the pursuit of a 1%, 2% gain, et cetera, in our ability to predict future crime and protect the public from it.
A view of actuarial risk assessments in the criminal justice system. We've been talking with Sonia B. Starr, who's a professor of law at the University of Michigan and the co-director of the Center for Empirical Legal Studies. Sonia, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on.